Hey, folks, before we start this week's episode, we want to tell you about this special event happening Friday, March 27th at the Hard Rock Cafe here in Seattle as part of the festivities surrounding the Emerald City Comic-Con, Crackle Fest 5, featuring openers Cy Fried and Meg Ran and Seattle area burlesque, not to mention the band Kirby Crackle. Yeah, it's going to be great, man. Did I say burlesque? Yes, I did. It's going to be there, and it was fantastic last year. It's going to be even better this year. And it's hosted by me, Aaron of the Air Raid Podcast. So get your tickets now. They're $10 in advance. You can go to KirbyCracklemusic.com, click on the show poster, and it'll take you directly there, or visit our show blog for this here episode and click the link and get your tickets now. Let's do this, man. Let's do it. Let's have a great time together. Okay, let's start the show. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 237 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom indeed, folks. We've got a great show planned for you this week. Yes. Yes, we do. Like every week, nothing changes here. But we've got a great show planned for you. Lincoln Barr, fantastic guitar player, is going to be coming in talking about his band, Red Jacket Mine. That's been a band here in Seattle for quite some time, man, and he's got a very interesting story. I've known Lincoln for quite some time. We've been acquaintances for quite a few years here, because I used to go down to this guitar store called Emerald City Guitars here in Seattle, one of my favorite spots on the planet, and just love this store. And Lincoln used to work down there, and we would chat up, about all of our like dream vintage equipment. He's just a fantastic guy. We have a fantastic conversation. But before we do that, we've got to get into a couple of things here. We got an actual voicemail. We haven't gotten one of those in a while, so we'll play that for you. And we've got, we got a bunch of emails, but I'm just going to read one on this episode and then save some for some other episodes here. But, I would like to say this before we get into all that. I would like to say this. We have been experiencing a lot of love on this show sent our way, just from people I've been meeting out in real life, in IRL, I didn't need to say in, right? That's already in there. Meeting people, meeting listeners out in the world, and getting emails, getting voicemails, and stuff like that about how much you guys are liking this program. And I gotta say, man, in all seriousness, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much. Thank you guys for listening to the show and continuing to support us. It's just great. I'm starting to tear up right now a little bit just thinking about it, because we've never, at any point during this show, in the 5 years we've been doing it, we haven't experienced this much appreciation and this much feedback, like positive feedback, I should say. So thank you. Thank you all for listening to the program, and thank you all for, sending us the love. And here's one that we got. Here's an email that we got from a listener, Elijah. Hey, I'm a new subscriber and I seriously love your podcast. Thank you, sir. The Lost Lander episode is my favorite so far, but I was wondering, do you take suggestions for guests? Because I have a few bands that I love, and unfortunately, they never get any interviews because they're not very good with self-promotion. Ha ha. Love, Elijah Harrell. Okay. Listener Elijah, thank you so much, dude, for reaching out. We really appreciate it. And if you, listening, would like to reach out, you can... You can email me, Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at air-raid.net. We love getting suggestions for bands like Elijah sent here, and, you know, anything else. Constructive criticism. You can send that in. You can send that in. So to answer your question, Elijah, we do. We take suggestions from people. If you'd like us to check out maybe your band or somebody else's band, a friend's band like Elijah's here, we will do that, man. Yeah, we take the time to check things out. We always want to hear about new music. That's the whole point of this show, right? Is to find out about new upcoming artists and some established acts as well on the national scene. And, yeah, we love finding out about new stuff. So send it our way, man. Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at air-raid.net. So thank you so much for the email there, buddy. Okay, now, we have this voicemail, and we haven't done a lot with the voicemail in a long time. Let's see. But I'm just gonna play this really quick. It's a quick one, and we'll chat about it here in just a second. Here we go.
Hi, Aaron. My name is John Myers. I heard you needed an intro for your show, so I thought I'd help you out here. I don't know if you like it or not, but I heard you had Duff on this week, and that was awesome. So I thought I'd just shoot this over to you. I'm not really drunk. I'm halfway drunk and dolling you. So check it out. Thanks.
Thanks, Aaron. Later.
Thank you, listener John. That was great. That was fantastic. I don't remember asking for a new intro though. But you know what? We'll keep that one in the archives, and when we need one, we'll access it. We'll do that. Oh man, that was great. That was great. Thank you so much, John. And John actually bought our very last T-shirt. From our merch store, and he also bought a poster too. So John, I will get to that this week. That stuff will be sent to you. That's a personal message for John. Anyway, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, this is something that we've not promoted very much, but if people like it, you can do it. It's still there. 609-232-BOOM. 609-232-2666. That's the phone number you can call and leave us a voicemail. And if we start getting more of these, maybe we'll just start playing more of them too, won't we? Yeah, we'll do that. Okay. Hey, let's see. Let's get into it, shall we? We're going to feature music today from the band, from Lincoln Barr's band, Red Jacket Mine. Someone Else's Cake. All right? Yeah, let's do that. And when we return, we'll be talking with a special guest this week, Lincoln Barr, of the band Red Jacket Mine. All right, this is Someone Else's Cake, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us. But they'll drag you kicking to the gallows before you're done. Maybe then you'll finally learn that eventually witches burn. Go put your fat fingers in someone else's cake. Someone else's cake. That I would notice someone else's cake. Everybody makes mistakes, but with mitts like yours, you're catching all the blame. Had me begging for more, more, more pain. Now I should've had your voice. Never knew I had a
Canada.
Probably.
So oh, really? So a while ago.
I know. It feels like I worked there for years, but I actually only worked there for a year and a half.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I know. It felt like...
Fuck, because that was like, that must have been like the year and a half that I was stopping by down there, yeah, like every weekend.
Did you work in the area at the time or you came down on the weekend? I definitely remember you coming in.
Yeah, because I used to come in all the time, but I think, 2006. Why the hell was I down there? I think my wife, who you met inside, used to work down there. And so I would just, every chance I would get, I would just, you know, go down there, meet her, you know. And then we used to, because our families live over on the Kitsap Peninsula, we would always take the Bainbridge Island Ferry.
Oh, and you'd
be waiting. Every time I'd just like, I would carve out like an hour before the ferry that I could just go down there and hang out.
It was, I think it feels like I worked there for way longer than I did because it was such a critical sort of juncture in my life. Yeah. You know what I mean? I just moved to Seattle and about a month later I started working there. And it changed everything for me. I met, you know, like all the people I play with, all the people, the bands that I know, all the gear that I have. You know what I mean?
So. Did you get special prices on that stuff?
Sometimes, you know, it depended on what it was, but there are definitely
You couldn't get like the 1954 Fender Stratocaster for $500.
No, no, but you know, I mean, I'd tell you more than special prices, although, you know, Jay was very generous with me. You know, you got an insight into what was coming down the line. And that is pretty valuable. I've got a Vox AC30, early 70s one that was the only AC30 that came in the entire time that I worked there.
Really?
And Jay got it from a car dealer from, like, he has a car dealership in Kent or Fife or something like that, but he's a Polish guy. Bought it in Europe in the 70s.
No shit.
And I'll never forget the day that he brought it in. Was just like...
You must have seen some shit down there because, like, that was okay. So, for people who don't know, this Emerald City Guitars is this shop down in Pioneer Square in downtown Seattle, right near the waterfront. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stores in the country because it's just chock full of just vintage instruments.
Yeah.
All analog, man. That's my thing. I love the analog stuff.
And same here.
And I remember you used to work down there, you and I would always talk about Jazz Masters.
Totally. Yeah.
Because I was highly obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. With those, which I still am, and could just never afford it.
Yeah.
And you would always I was so jealous of you. You just had, like, you showed me pictures of your Jazz Master one time, I think I remember.
Yeah.
Still
got it.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful guitar.
Yeah, I love it, man. It's a fraud, but it's a very nice fraud.
Is it? A fraud? What do you mean fraud?
Well, it was it's put together. It's not a Fender guitar. It's not a vintage Fender guitar.
But it's Fender parts, though, right?
It's Fender licensed parts.
Okay.
The only real part on the guitar, and this is trade secret here, but is the tremolo. It's the vibrato unit because the new ones aren't the same. They suck.
Right.
So I had to buy like a 63 vibrato off eBay or something.
Yeah.
But
well, I went, as you can see, I went a little crazy.
I like it.
Like for a while
good
there.
Crazy.
And good crazy. But you know, a lot of these, like especially this Mustang up here, this old blue guitar.
That's awesome.
Like I had to piece that together from a bunch of
vintage
parts.
Did you get them off eBay?
eBay, and other places, you know. Stores over in Chicago and stuff.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about a Fender, man. They were made to be that way.
Yeah,
they were made to be taken apart and put back together. And if you break the neck, just get a new one.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's not like a SG where the neck is going to break.
Right.
And you're going to have to repair it, and the guitar is still never going to be the same.
Is that a thing with an SG, man? Because holy shit, I had a 72 SG with a broken neck.
Almost all of them, the neck's been broken, unless they've been kept in a, you know, hyperbaric chamber.
I sold it to some asshole. I sold it to some asshole. Traded him for that Mustang.
Serves him right.
Yeah. This jerk. Lincoln Barr joining me in the backyard. Lincoln, you are the front man and brains behind Red Jacket Mine, correct?
That's true. Yeah, guilty as charged.
Yeah, how long has Red Jacket Mine been going on?
Well, let's see. I started recording under that name in 2003 when I still lived in Missouri. And then I moved to Seattle. I got here on New Year's Eve 2003. 2004. So
New Year's Eve. You came over on New Year's Eve?
Yeah, my wife and I drove from Missouri, and we left on December 27th or 8th and got here on December 31st, 2004.
Holy shit, man.
Because I had just graduated and we had to get the hell out of there, man.
Missouri just wasn't cutting it.
No, it wasn't.
Where in Missouri are you from?
I was born, and then I went to college in southeast Missouri, a little town on the Mississippi River called Cape Girardeau. Very small.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's a small place. It's about 100 miles south of St. Louis.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And then I lived in Mississippi and Arkansas and other parts of Missouri, too, when I was growing up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why were you moving around so much?
Well, that's a good question.
Parents doing stuff?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
They meth addicts?
It wasn't my choice.
Were your parents meth addicts, Duncan?
They kept it hid very well. they were Jesus addicts, I think.
Oh, okay.
But that wasn't really the reason that we moved. There was just some sort of nomad spirit in my family that I can't quite explain, but I think it's...
So you got it in the blood.
Always searching for something better. There's got to be something better out there, yeah, for sure.
Wow, so it wasn't even work that,
was always an excuse, work-related excuse.
Okay.
But, my dad, we weren't in the military. My dad was an insurance adjuster. So
he could go anywhere, though. He could find a job doing that stuff.
Absolutely.
Anywhere, right?
And he did.
Well, that's good.
And it was mostly really, really good. I mean, to this day, I consider Memphis, Tennessee, where the place in Mississippi that I lived is right across the state line from Memphis.
Okay.
And that place is sort of home for me. In my mind. You know what I mean? And
a lot of music going on.
Absolutely.
There.
And I lived there at a critical time. I got my first electric guitar, Nirvana and all that stuff came out around that time.
Sure.
And so that was sort of a coming of age thing for me. And I would have, if my family had just stayed in one place, I would have never got the opportunity to meet those people. And you know what I mean? It was really cool, but not always easy.
Yeah. Yeah. How old were you when you guys moved first?
Oh God. Two something. Yeah.
2 years old.
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 32.
You're 32.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So literally from a young age, from a very young age, you guys are picking up and moving to a different spot.
Absolutely. I mean, put it this way. My wife and I have lived in my apartment in Ballard for longer than I've ever lived anywhere in my life.
Really?
6 years. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's insane, man. Like, what does that do to a kid?
Well,
that's got to kind of mess you up just a little bit.
I think it does, and I'm only starting to wrap my head around the possibility that it could have. But I,
you're only now realizing
it's that time in my life. It's a very introspective time in my life. But, I think that on the good side, I think, when you're a kid, you really need the opportunity to reinvent yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're around people who have all known you for many, many years, that's a really difficult thing to do.
Right.
Like I remember when I moved back to Missouri to go to high school, I left Memphis and I'd gone to a fully integrated school. There were probably 300 and something kids in my class, kind of suburban. I left there and I went to a school where it was 100% white and my class was 20 people. And everybody else in my class, they'd known each other since kindergarten. So it was all,
That's tough.
Do you remember
dude.
When you shit your pants in second grade? Oh, God, that was hilarious.
Yeah.
I was like an alien, man. I had just dropped in there from no place. Nobody
knew.
Well,
especially
any
a
of the
tiny
history.
School like that,
totally.
Too. Like, that's a tight knit group right mm-hmm. there. You get a new kid that comes into such a tight knit group. I mean, I remember when the new kid would move into, wherever and start coming to the elementary school that I went to, mm-hmm. which took a number of different towns.
Totally. Yeah.
And it was much bigger than just 20 kids. But I just remember, man, that must have been the hardest fucking thing in the world to be a young kid and have to pick up and move to a new place.
I think it was. I think I was used to it by that point, and I think I had even kind of convinced myself that I liked it. I think I did like part of it. You know what I mean? Ultimately,
because you could
I think
do that reinventing yourself.
You don't
thing.
Know me. You don't know where I came from. You didn't remember when I was a fat kid or anything
sure.
like that.
But
there's also benefits to having that sort of stability and continuity, and that's definitely not something that we were accustomed
that
to.
You had
yeah
oh that stinks mm. stinks so
that's
this
my life.
Like the your life sucks no so was the small town that was the uh that was the uh what what was the name of the town again?
Which one? Cape Girardeau, Missouri?
Cape Girardeau. Yeah. Was that that was the small, tiny town?
No, no. But that's where I went to college. It's near
there. Oh, okay.
There. Yeah.
Gotcha.
The
gotcha.
Small town I moved to was called Zalma, Missouri. Shout out to Zalma, Missouri. Population 83.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's that like?
That's where I went to high school. It was very weird.
You went to high school in a town with only 83 people?
Yeah. 20 people in my graduating class.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Was that there must have been some backwoods shit going on.
Oh,
there,
God, yeah. Oh, my God.
Do you remember this? Like, is this a clear memory for you?
Oh,
I guess you
yeah.
went to high school there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I was, sure, you know, 14, 15,
yeah?
16. Yeah, man. That place is, you know, it's there's some real nice people there, but it's backwoods. Like, you would,
right.
like you, it's straight out of the movies. Sling Blade or something, you know, in,
right.
many, in many ways.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it was weird.
How old were you when you guys moved there?
I was 14.
14 years old.
Yeah, I'm moving from Mississippi.
How there. Do you get anything from the outside world? Like what?
The internet. The internet had just sprung up, and that saved my life, man.
Really?
Yeah, because I immediately...
So that's how you find out about like Nirvana and stuff?
Well,
and
yeah. I think at the time, you know, I was probably... When I moved away from Mississippi, I was just... I was actually had gotten really into like... you know, arcane sort of like blues stuff, maybe
sure.
like the Allman Brothers. I'd been playing guitar long enough that I was kind of moving on from like the, your Green Days of the world to,
sure.
to something a little more sophisticated. But I think that it actually really sort of engendered something in me that I think I still have today is just like, there's this whole community out there. There are people out there like me. And I remember I had a pen pal, a kid that lived in Carbonear, Newfoundland.
Uh-huh.
Which is a small town in Newfoundland.
Right.
But we somehow found each other through, I don't know, a message board or something like that. And we would send each other tapes. And that was my lifeline to the outside world. And I found out about a shit ton of music that way, man.
Wow, you actually did that?
Oh, God, yeah.
Pen pal?
Dude, I have that bone in my body for sure, man. Like,
really?
I know. And I that's how I found out about like the Velvet Underground, all the Jam, the Clash.
From a kid in Finland?
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
Yeah, and then I had an older person that I shared music with
uh-huh.
out in L.A. And,
okay.
He sent me tapes of, like, yeah, the VU, the Jam. I remember I had a tape that kicked off with Start or Pretty Green or something off one of those middle period Jam records.
Sure.
And it just kicked my fucking ass, man. Yeah. I was a kid, and I was listening to the Allman Brothers and Smashing Pumpkins and shit like that at the time. And
right.
then it was completely turned my head around.
Yeah. What kid wasn't? Well, maybe not the Allman Brothers, but like...
yeah, very few.
Yeah, yeah.
although in Zalma, I don't think the Smashing Pumpkins had even made their way to Zalma, Missouri
right.
yet.
Right,
it was,
right.
Like I said, I was an alien. Me and all my brothers. I have three younger brothers. And
oh, wow.
We just dropped in there out of Mars, pretty much.
So what did your parents do in a place like that?
Oh, well, my dad was an insurance adjuster.
Yeah?
And my mom was a homemaker. And
wow.
that was pretty much it. We lived out on, you know, 13 acres and pretty isolated.
Wow. So you're, like, super far away from any neighbor then?
Yeah, pretty far away from any neighbors.
13 acres, that's a big
yeah,
plot of land.
Definitely. Mostly woods.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, we were probably 10 miles from town, like mm-hmm. the 83-person town.
Yeah.
And about an hour away from, like, the bigger town where they had stuff. You know, an Applebee's or something. You know, signs of life.
Right, right. One thing I remember, because I grew up in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to bro down with you here.
Bro down.
I grew up in the woods. I grew up in a small town, and I always remember because I was always really into horror movies.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. as a kid, you know, especially
I couldn't watch those. That I wasn't allowed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh
but
man!
Go on.
But see, it's a good thing because I, you know, most horror movies in the 80s take place in the woods.
Yes.
Right. You got, and you know, all of your, you know, camps, summer camp movies and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
All the killers that are in the woods. And that was the worst because every time I would watch one of those movies, I'd have just extreme nightmares because, mm-hmm. first of all, we live in the woods.
Right.
Second of all, you know, you're watching, you know, my parents let me, you know, watch whatever I wanted pretty much. And so I would watch multiple.
At once?
Not at once, but, you know, maybe two a night on a Saturday
okay,
or something
sure.
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, man, just be freaked out for weeks just because of that. Because, you know...
That was my wife's upbringing, basically. You know, nobody's home, so it's just like all bets are off. You know, and yeah, she definitely has. She still has nightmares because of it.
Well, it's a good thing you weren't allowed to watch scary movies. What was that like? The Christian upbringing?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Just we actually stopped celebrating Halloween when I was about 7 years old. We were told that Halloween was over.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So they were like going in. Like
yeah,
they were
well,
getting
I think
in
it had always been part of it,
stuff.
But I think it was more just like ever striving for to be closer to thee kind of thing, you know. And if and also, you know, I think people use that, and I'm not, you know, I love my parents, but people use that if there are circumstances going on in the outside that aren't you're not happy about. If you're a religious person and you're of that persuasion and you're also of like we were Pentecostal, so like that's a very personal kind of, it's not just like, well, I go to church and it's a social thing, it's like hallelujah kind of religion.
Right,
and
right. A lot of singing.
Oh, singing, dancing, speaking in tongues, rolling on the floor, all that. So I think that if you're of that persuasion, if there are circumstances on the outside that you don't like, you're looking inside to be like, well, how can I get closer to God so that my life gets better?
Right.
So God blesses me or takes away these challenges that I have or
sure,
things like
sure.
that. So there could have been something to that.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, it's starting to make sense where your sound now with Red Jacket Mine comes from, because you do have a very gospel style of singing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's definitely my background, even before the, you know, Smashing Pumpkins. That's,
right,
you
right.
know, and I was listening to that. For
well,
sure.
You were forced to.
Yes, I was. But, you know, gospel music, I'm not a religious person or a spiritual person even, but I, you know, I still love gospel music.
Sure,
so,
sure. Yeah, what's not to love about it, man?
I can't think of anything.
It's great. It's like some of the most soulful,
the good
stuff
is about as good as music is, because it's what music is for.
Right. Right. I mean, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I also hear a lot of that old '60s style guitar playing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're playing like a jazz master in this band too, which is amazing. Love that guitar. And a lot of like almost like an Elvis Costello
type
sound.
Absolutely. Huge fan of his. I mean, he's one of my songwriting heroes for sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
And those records, you know, immensely important to me.
Sure, sure. So a lot of this stuff, I mean, you're basically, your sound is, a lot of it is centering around what you were learning about at the age of 14.
Sure. Yeah, I think that there's a case to be made there. And I think that actually Red Jacket Mine, over the, it's sort of 10-year, I mean, it's, we've been playing in Seattle since 2005, so we're coming up on 10 years here. Over our 10-year evolution as a band, we've actually kind of come all the way back around probably to what I originally intended the band to be when I was just a kid with a 4-track and a copy of, you know, Guided by Voices B-1000 or something.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah.
I envisioned it being much more of a pop thing, and I also, you know, I was definitely listening to a ton of Elvis Costello, and that's, you know, like I said, The Jam, Paul Weller, Joe Jackson, and then that the like R&B soul gospel thing that has always been something that I love.
Sure.
And now we have the lineup and I have the songs and the wherewithal to actually assert that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And not try to pretend to be something that I'm not, which I might have done, might be guilty of in the past, but who isn't?
I think everybody is, yeah, for sure. So you're growing up in the backwoods. This still just boggles my mind. The population of 80.
It still boggles mine.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. So, I mean, what are you thinking as a kid? Like, do you want to get out of there.
Absolutely.
I take it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're not, that's not you, right?
No, that's not me, and I think I always, you know, I mean, escape was all on my mind from an early age, I think, and I think that I definitely, after getting a taste of, I mean, even though, to be honest, where I lived in Mississippi was the burbs. We were close enough to Memphis and what was going on in Memphis at the time, and there was like a kick-ass alternative sort of radio station, and I would hear about shows. I never got to go to those shows. But I would hear about shows going on at the New Daisy Theater or some of these other cool places in Memphis.
And I felt connected to that, and I knew that was out there.
Yeah.
And then
were you allowed to go to any of these shows?
Oh, hell no. No, not at all. But I could listen to the radio. I mean, so I wasn't completely cut off. I could daydream about what it might be like.
Right.
And so I think that was on my mind from an early age. So definitely as I was in high school, and I had basically nobody that I felt any sort of a kinship with. Mm-hmm. Nobody else played music or anything like that at my school.
What'd they do for fun?
Meth.
Really?
Yeah.
Even at that age?
Drinking, shooting things, lots of hunting in that area. Yeah, and then on the other hand, there was like the church youth group sort of scene.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
Which I gravitated toward in high school because that was really what was available to me, and I could play music there. You know what I mean?
You could play in the church band.
Totally.
Yeah.
Which I did a lot of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, until I was about 17, 18. Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens when you go to college? Is that like a huge culture shock?
It was, well, it was what I'd always been waiting for, I think.
Sure.
You know, I didn't want to go to college. I had it in my mind from an early age because, you know, I remember actually, I guess this has always been a thing, but it was a little more visible in the mid 90s, these sort of kid bands, like, you remember, Silverchair?
Oh yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
they were like 16 or something.
Right.
That was a deal. And then, that guy, you know, the singer songwriter, Ben Queller, he's from Texas.
Yes.
He had a band like in the 90s called Radish or something like that. And they were like 14, man. They were little kids. And they got signed to a big record deal. And I mean, it was cool to, you know, the music is whatever. But I had it in my mind, like, I'm ready. I'm ready to go do this. I'm ready to go on the road.
That's what you were going to do.
And I didn't have a band. And I really didn't have songs. I hadn't really started writing songs yet. But I was just like, I got to go do this. This is me. And I didn't want to go to college at all. My parents sort of talked me into it. And I was able to get a scholarship. Like a full ride scholarship, which is good because we were so poor and we couldn't have paid for it at all. And so I'm like, okay, well, if it's free, and I'll go, you know what I mean? And I'm glad I did because it was a total, you know, formative experience for me. I met my wife there.
Uh-huh.
I, you know, it was college. I don't need to explain what college is. and that was really important. You know what I mean? It really bought me some time to really decide who I wanted to be.
Sure.
Which was very, you know, critical.
Yeah. Yeah. So you got to reinvent yourself one more time.
One more time, you know, and it wasn't the last time probably, but it was an important time, you know
sure.
what I mean? Because that really allowed me to break out of completely shake loose of, you know, my childhood or, you know, adolescent trappings and the religion that I grew up in and all that, you know what I mean? And
did you like when you got to college, did you shake off the religion part?
It took me a couple, 3 years maybe to really kind of say, finally, you know, one day it was just like, oh, I don't really need this anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I'm doing these intellectual backflips to try to shoehorn this religion into my life somehow or make it make sense knowing what I know today.
Right.
And then finally it was just like the last straw broke, you know what I mean? And I just couldn't do that anymore.
What was the last straw? Do you know?
God, I don't really know. I don't know. Yeah. I just remember really doing, and I think this is a pretty common thing in talking with some other people, but just like it could be something as simple as like, oh, I've never known a gay person before. Oh,
right.
You mean they're not, you know, some sort of ghoul or something? They're a normal person. Okay, well, I got to fit that into my worldview now.
Right.
You know?
It's a bunch of different puzzle pieces.
Exactly.
That,
and you start
to carve out
your world just gets so much bigger, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then it gets harder and harder to fit it back into that same little box that you've had it in for the first part of your life.
It's a really good way to explain that.
I've never really thought of it that way, but I think that's what it is. It just keeps expanding. And I keep thinking, well, there's a way for me to justify all this. And, you know, I don't have to believe in the same type of God that my parents believed in. Or, you know, I don't have to, I can have a more enlightened view. And I think some people are able to do that and sustain that through their adulthood. And, you know, but ultimately for me, I was just kind of like, I don't need this to be happy anymore.
Right, right.
You know, or to justify anything that I'm doing. You know what I mean? And so but that took, that took several years for sure to really say, okay, Yeah, I guess that was, I was probably a little bit deluded.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's go to our second musical break. We're featuring music from the band Red Jacket Mine, the band that Lincoln Barr here had heads. What the hell is that? Heads? No. You're the lead singer. You're the guitar player,
songwriter,
booker, manager.
Everything.
Tour manager.
Yeah.
This song is called Poplar Bluff, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Lincoln Barr of the band Red Jacket Mine. All right, Poplar Bluff, we'll be right back. Stay with us. No, it's not my decision time. It's written on the door. You can be Poplar Bluff.
Well, Poplar Bluff is this town. It's sort of it's maybe an hour or so west of where I went to high school. So, and about 2 hours west of where I went to college. And it is sort of like the evil doppelganger of Cape Girardeau, Missouri. It's kind of like I don't know. In my mind, it always just represented all that was bad in the world. And I have this vague memory of like going to the Walmart there, because that's where you shop, no matter where you live in Missouri.
Yeah, right.
And I remember going to the Walmart there and it being like a, you know, Middle Eastern bazaar or something. Like in my, you know, like there, it's like a flea market. There are like kiosks set up and like a camel.
Blankets hanging all over the place.
A camel walking through the aisles or something. It was just really bizarre, even, you know, and.
But instead of like ornate tapestry, it's like just American eagles, bald eagles on everything
exactly,
and American flags.
Exactly. Yeah. Like sweatshirts with wolves on them and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Poplar Bluff is just, it's just a rough place, man. I pity anyone that's got to live there because there's a lot of bad stuff going on, bad vibes, you know? I think places have memories sometimes and you can just feel it when you get there, and Poplar Bluff's one of those places.
Do you just hate Missouri? Is that what's going on?
I don't like Missouri. I can't say I like it. No, you'd be hard pressed to come up with a state that has a more conflicted history than Mississippi, but I've fucking love Mississippi, man. Yeah, I go there and I'm like, I love this place. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff that happens and happened here that I hate and despise. But the place itself is powerful to me.
Sure.
Missouri never had that. It's just, maybe it's just familiarity breeds contempt, but Missouri is very low on charm for me.
I went to St. Louis once.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. I had a good time there.
That's good.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time in St. Louis. I mean, that when I was in college, my wife and I were in college, we went there every weekend.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was the what was available to us. So they have a great fucking radio station. I'll say that. KDHX.
I never heard
St. Louis is an awesome station. And I heard so much music for the first time on that, driving back and forth to St. Louis. Captain Beefheart, Uncle Tupelo, all these things just blew my head wide open. You know,
sure,
I was
18
or 19 years old.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I went there. I visited for just a couple days. I was trying to get an ex-girlfriend back.
Okay, and she was in St. Louis?
She was in St. Louis. She was going to school at Wash U.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Ivy League school over there. I don't know why I'm slurring my speech, but I feel like I am.
Yeah, but what did you say you were drinking tonight?
Vodka. I haven't really drinking that much.
Drinking? No, drinkin'. I don't think you've drinking enough, probably.
No, so I go over to Missouri, or to St. Louis. From here.
Did you drive?
No.
Oh, okay. No, I flew. You didn't love her that much.
Well, I'm glad that it didn't work out.
Okay.
Because, then I wouldn't have my two beautiful girls, you know, and my wonderful wife.
I counted three.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But, yeah, I don't know. It was hot as shit. That's what I remember. And,
it's really hot.
The experience was just super awkward because she was an ex-girlfriend. She had started seeing somebody else. And here I come.
You were that guy.
Trying to, you know, win her back and sleeping on the floor of her apartment. So,
oh my God.
Very awkward.
That's rough, man. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I think back to that time and I'm just like, man, you're an asshole. Like, I was an asshole. That was a dick move.
Yeah. Well, she let you sleep on the floor of her apartment.
Yeah. I mean, that was nice.
She couldn't have been that upset.
Oh, shit. I haven't thought about that in a long time.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Missouri, man.
Yeah, I know.
Missouri brings it out in you.
I have similarly tortured memories.
So you met your wife. You met your wife in college. You were about 18 years old.
You got it. That's exactly right.
Wow. You guys have been together for a long time.
Yeah. 14 years.
Dang.
Yeah.
Wow.
When you know, man.
I guess
she's
so.
Good woman.
I guess so. So what brought you guys out to Seattle? What was the whole, why move this far west?
Well, we had visited, so we knew we wanted to get out of there. And my wife had a similar, you know, thing of like, I got to get out of this place as soon as possible.
Was she from there? She was born and raised?
She was born in Belleville, Illinois, which is like where Uncle Tupelo and those guys are from. It's just east of St. Louis.
Gotcha.
And then she lived in a tiny town in Missouri called St. Genevieve, in, you know, school, high school and stuff.
Yeah.
So similar, but, you know, she wanted to get out of there. She moved to Cape Girardeau for me, and we went to college there for a while. And then, but when I graduated, we were like, okay, let's get out of here. And we had visited Seattle and Vancouver and Victoria in early 2004. And that was like, this was the Bush years. And so everybody was like, I'm moving to Canada. You know what I mean? And we thought that was a good idea. But once we got out here, we're like, well, Vancouver was cool, but I actually really, really liked Seattle.
Yeah.
So we just made the plans and got the U-Haul and moved out here.
Yeah. Plus it's easier. You don't have to get like a green card.
That was definitely appealing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm really glad we did because, I mean, I've got some of my best friends live in Vancouver. I love to go there, but I like living here a lot more than I would like living there, I think.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Vancouver's odd.
Yeah.
I like to visit.
Totally.
I would hate living there.
Yeah, I think I would too, actually.
You know, unless you live on the outskirts of the city.
Mm-hmm.
But man, the inside of that city is awesome to visit. But man, there are some problems in that city.
Yeah.
You know, like huge, huge drug issues.
Downtown East Side, yeah.
Yeah, dude. Mm-hmm. Like hardcore drug issues. I mean, I've been up there numerous times. Every time I'm there, I see some really fucked up shit.
Something like you've never seen before. Like, oh my God, 28 days later kind of shit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
I know.
Very much so. Yeah. 28 days later.
It's grim. It's really grim, man. I mean,
Oh, God. We went up there in a big group one time and we were walking around Chinatown.
Uh-huh.
And there was a guy just like slumped over in a stairwell mm-hmm. like doorway to an apartment, right? And it was all enclosed, and he was slumped over. He wasn't wearing any shoes, and he had a bag of spray paint cans.
Oh God!
Like a plastic bag full, like he had just gone to the store, and he had a needle sticking out of his arm, and he was totally slumped over and passed out, and his, you know. It was like he had just passed out when we like crossed his path,
mm-hmm.
and he like his arm went out, you know, dropped down, and a, you know, silver spray paint can just goes rolling across the sidewalk.
Mm.
I remember looking up at him and I was like, "Is that guy dead? Did he just die?
Did I just see someone die?
Did we just witness a soul leaving a body?" And I'm like looking at him because we all stop and everybody's just like aghast mm-hmm. at this. You know, I mean, we went to college in Ellensburg. So this was when we were all in college in, you know, small town. And I just like I walk up to the guy and he's still breathing, but he's just got, you know, silver spray paint all around his lips. And I was just like, holy shit. And, you know, a needle sticking
paint
out of his arm.
And
just crazy.
And a needle.
Right. Holy. I mean, he was taking it to a new level.
I gotta say, though, he's remarkably coordinated for a junkie, though. That's right. Incredible. How'd he pull that off?
And he had a whole bag.
Did he have some sort of apparatus holding the paint can in
place? Oh, my God. Or, you know,
did he have help?
Right. Or he just had that needle, like, sticking out for hours not knowing it.
That's possible. You know? That is possible.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Round on money.
Yikes.
Like, oh, I better go get some spray paint. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but Vancouver, man, that's a crazy place.
There's some great, great stuff there and great people, great bands. But, mm-hmm. It's just not it doesn't feel as friendly to me as Seattle.
Yeah,
just,
and it's a big city, too.
Yeah.
It's a very large city.
Yeah, and it has a kind of, that more. It has more of a large city vibe, you know,
sure.
A little more kind of cosmopolitan. Whereas Seattle feels more small towny. I mean, we have a lot of the best stuff, but... you can still get around
right
neighborhood to neighborhood pretty
yeah, well. Yeah, yeah, totally. So was music still like at that point in your life, music was still like the thing, right?
Absolutely.
Is that still what you're reaching for at that point?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, when I moved out here, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, that was the whole idea, is like, we have to go someplace. I had been, like I said, kind of writing and recording stuff and releasing. I'd released a couple of CDs just of my four track songs in 2003. And they're like, well, there's nobody for me to play with here. There's nowhere to play.
Yeah.
I've got to get someplace where there are other musicians that want to do
right.
what I'm doing.
So you needed to go to a place with a scene.
Absolutely.
There had to be a music scene.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think so.
And this was let's see, what year was that?
2005 was basically
2005?
Was when I got here, yeah.
Yeah, so the scene was starting to pop again.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, I do. I mean, it's like a little bit pre, like, Fleet Foxes kind
sure.
of era.
Right.
But definitely it had kind of, I think it would seem from talking to people like maybe the early 2000s, late 90s weren't as exciting,
no.
you know, but...
No, it started to die.
Yeah,
like there wasn't a whole lot going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Like I wasn't as involved in it as I am now, but mm-hmm. just from an outsider's perspective, it didn't seem like it was that lively.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Still, you had your outside acts that were coming through. I mean, it's a major city,
totally.
So you know people are still coming through. But yeah, it wasn't like it was starting to pop again. In like 2004, 2005,
yeah.
That's when things started to feel like they were coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember calling a buddy of mine in around that time, like 2005 or so, mm-hmm. and just being like, man, you got to move out here. It's super exciting
right
now.
Yeah.
You know, like there's just something's going on every night.
Yeah.
You know, your band can find a spot to play.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be the best venue in the world,
right.
but you can always find a place to play,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, yeah, it was super exciting. So coming from an outsider's perspective like yourself, where you were coming from across the country.
Yeah.
Like, what was your feeling towards that? Like,
oh,
were you pretty excited to get out here?
It was Candyland for me, man.
Yeah.
It was totally Candyland for
sure.
me. And I, you know, it was completely intoxicating, actually, to you know, to all of a sudden, I know these people in these other bands. And I think this band is fucking incredible. You know?
Right, right.
And I know that guy.
Yeah.
And they put me on the guest list. What? Guest list? You know, I mean, this was even a real, I didn't even have the language, you know what
sure.
I mean?
coming from where I did, you know, I barely knew anybody else in a band. There was barely a bar to play at that wasn't just cover bands or like kind of old man blues, you know what I mean, kind of stuff. And not the good kind of old man blues, you know what I mean? Like
white,
old man,
white
retired lawyer blues.
Exactly. I was going to say yacht blues.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right. Right.
We called it actually, there's a bar in Cape Girardeau called Broussard's that's ostensibly a Cajun restaurant.
Sure.
But we call it Broussard's Blues, actually, where we were from. Yeah, because that they had a certain flavor of
I don't know
blues.
That place, but I knew exactly
you know what
I'm talking about.
Totally. You know. So yeah, that was the only experience that I really had. I mean, I would play gigs at a coffee shop there.
Sure.
And that was, and I would make those into what the coolest thing that I knew how to make them, you know, but there was no scene. And
right,
so yeah,
right.
when I arrived in Seattle and then I started working at Emerald City Guitars about a month after that, and all of a sudden I was
Well, and that was the let me stop you right there because that was the fucking place too.
Totally.
I mean, you had like rock stars coming into
absolutely
that. Like I remember standing there one time and Ben Gibbard walked in and you guys took him to the back room.
Oh really?
Yeah, and because you know he wanted to try out one of the guitars that was in the glass case.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And it was just like holy shit. And then I started looking at all the photos and stuff.
Oh,
you know,
God,
you got
yeah.
all sorts of crazy mm-hmm. people coming in there all the time. It was great.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was amazing. Like after a while, you like anything, you sort of get used to it and you all, and then after a certain amount of time, like you build up the sort of like, oh yeah, I'm cool. I can just like, I can hang with these guys and not make it a big deal. But yeah, on the inside, you're just freaking out, man. But, you know, I think the more amazing thing for me, obviously I was excited to meet people like that and be involved. But the bigger thing for me was actually knowing people as peers who were making music that I thought was world class.
Right.
You know, that was the thing that I had never had before. And that was so thrilling to me. It's like, I know these guys and we can play a show together. And I think this is a great fucking album. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was incredible because it was not something that I had experienced before.
Oh, that's great, man. Yeah. So when did Red Jacket Mine start? And by the way, what does that mean?
That is a coal mine. So basically when I was first starting out, you know, like I said, making four-track recordings, starting like getting them polished to the point where I'm like, well, I could put this out and like give it to people and not be ashamed. That doesn't mean I'm not ashamed of it now, you know what I mean? But, I mean, although some of those songs I still think are pretty damn good, but I didn't want to be another guy with an acoustic guitar, you know? And so I wanted to come up, and I also always had like, okay, this isn't a band today, but it's going to be a band. Like, that's going to be the vehicle eventually.
Right.
So I'm just going to go ahead and get a name for this thing, and then, but I didn't want to do some sort of the Wipers kind of band or something, you know what I mean? I didn't want to come up with a plural sort of thing. I wanted something that was pretty oblique and maybe was suggestive without meaning anything to me.
Sure.
And I was going through a lot of like Harry Smith folk anthologies and just looking at the titles because some of the titles are really fucked up. There's all these kind of religious imagery or things about weird places in the South and in the, you know, kind of Appalachian area, and I saw this thing that said the Red Jacket Mine Explosion by the Phipps Family, which is a folk song about a disaster that happened at a coal mine.
Oh, wow.
I think in West Virginia. And yeah, I thought Red Jacket Mine. Well, that doesn't mean anything, but it's suggestive. You know, it's a kind of a tongue twister, you know, but basically I decided on it in 2003 and I've been stuck with it ever since. You know what I mean? Because it's like I've stuck with this for so long now and I've sort of built up whatever kind of brand equity that I have, I've sunk it all into that. You know what I
totally,
mean?
Totally.
And you know, like there's a lot of dumb band names in the world. Spoon is a horrible band name.
Spoon. That is awful. I've had this conversation before. Hate that band name.
But it just, you know, but at this point, it doesn't mean Spoon anymore. It means this music, and you know whether you like that music or not, and that's what it stands for.
Right.
So, yeah, Red Jacket Mine doesn't really mean anything, but it is a coal mine. There you go.
So, and this all started as kind of a solo thing, just knowing that you were going to get a band someday.
Hoping that I was going to get a band someday.
Now, did you take out, like, a classified ad? Did you go that route?
We have done things like that. Basically, when I moved to Seattle, I already knew my drummer, Andy Salzman, who also worked with me at Emerald City Guitars.
Gotcha.
He had moved out to Seattle in the mid-90s, but he was originally from that town, Cape Girardeau, where I went to college.
Oh, really?
And we had mutual friends. And actually, some of the people that I had played music with out there had played music with him back in the 90s. And he came back to visit, and one time when I was making one of my four-track records, a record called The Daylight Moon that I put out in 2003, he was back home, back visiting his parents, and he played drums on it. So I already knew him. And it was by no means certain, like, that if I moved to Seattle, we were going to be in a band together, but that was a possibility, right? Like, it was somebody I knew that played drums and liked my songs. So he was the kind of the one number that I had when I moved to Seattle. So I moved here and I worked at Barnes & Noble for a couple weeks and I wanted to kill myself. And I called him up one night and I said, Andy, if there's any way you can get me on at the guitar shop, I got to get out of this place. Like, I'll do whatever you want me to do.
Right, right.
And so he and I already had, and actually our first shows as Red Jacket and Mine, the band, were just us, the guitar and drums duo. In fact, when I met you, that's probably what you guys were doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we actually had a conversation about that because I, at that time, was in a two-piece band as well called the Ministry of Love.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, okay. It's all making sense now.
Yeah.
Why didn't we ever line up a show together?
I don't really know. I think we had to be friends on MySpace.
Probably.
Surely.
Yeah.
Pull up our account and let's see if we're friends with the Ministry of Love.
Let's do that later. I don't even want to look at that old page.
I can't imagine what's going on MySpace now. It's probably incredible, though. Maybe actually it's made its way to Zalma, Missouri now. They're all on MySpace.
Like they Zalma, finally Missouri, got on the computers.
Like, yeah, Eritrea or Bangladesh or something. And like all the backwoods places on Earth.
There you go. There you go.
No offense to Eritrea or Bangladesh.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, we don't know. We don't really want to offend anybody. Except for Missourians.
Right, Missourians. Yeah. Is that what you said? Yeah.
Missourians?
Missourians, yeah. Missourians.
But that would be it?
Oh, yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
The newspaper in Cape Girardeau, is called the Southeast Missourian.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
So, look it up.
Who'd have thunk?
Someone, yeah.
So, you've been doing Red Jacket Mine for 10 years.
10 years, yeah.
10 years. Mm-hmm. Is it still labor of love?
Oh, God, like, yeah. I mean, you know, the music has, like I said earlier, I mean, it's actually gotten closer and closer through a very circuitous sort of path to actually, I think, what I originally set out to do.
Sure.
I just didn't necessarily have the tools to do it.
Right.
I fell in with a group of guys, Patrick Porter, who's been on this podcast
among them,
in the early days of being in Seattle. And I found myself writing to their strengths, which was awesome. You know what I mean? It was so inspiring to play with musicians that were really good and had their own sort of personality that I was writing for that. And I think we made a lot of really great music, but it wasn't necessarily indicative of the type of music that was closest to my heart. I believed in it passionately, but it wasn't like, I didn't think when I hatched the idea originally that I'd be writing these kind of slower, more atmospheric, soundscapey type of rock songs. I was thinking snappy, 2.5 minute, lots of chord changes, R&B kind of feel, you know.
Right,
and
right.
It just took me a long time to actually have the confidence and the toolkit to be able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. You mean like learning more about the instrument and learning like chords and things like that?
Yeah, and yeah, definitely. And then having the group of musicians around me that were adept in, you know, playing in that style. Yeah.
Being comfortable with playing with other people.
Totally, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool, man.
But yeah, man, I mean, it's awesome now. It's just, you know, the band, we've had our ups and downs over the years in terms of personnel issues, you know, success or the lack thereof, and had a lot of really great, you know, things happen and a lot of kind of shitty things happen, but the band sounds better than it ever has. Uh-huh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think this EP that we put out last year is the best music that we've made, along with Someone Else's Cake, the record that came out in 2013.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just pleased as punch with how those turned out and really proud. And so as long as it's fun, we're going to keep doing it.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So. I mean, is it always going to be something that you would like to attain to, like, is it the dream to be able to do music for a job? It's got to be, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And
it's kind of a dumb question.
I'd be really shocked if anybody, particularly anyone that, like, wrote songs and, you know, if you do it as a full-time job the way that I do. Like, I work a full-time job during the day, like, sure, most musicians, and I work at least that much on the band.
Oh, yeah, of course.
If you do it like that and you don't wish, man, I sure do wish I could just, this day job could become a thing of the past, or at least a side thing or something like that, then I'd be shocked that anyone would think of it that way. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's all I think about. You know what I mean? So I would love to be able to do it full time, but not many people get to do that. There's a lot of my heroes, even, you know, people that I think are great songwriters, you know, great artists that never got the chance or probably never will get the chance to do that. And that's been a big thing, actually, in sort of turning 30 and then kind of assessing, like, this is my life so far and this is where I'm at today, of realizing, like, you're not a failure as an artist if you're good at something else.
Sure.
I think it was very, like, zero-sum game. I either got to put all my energy into making music or I suck at it and I'm a failure.
Yeah.
You know, but that's just not true.
That's a really good point, though.
You're really, like, limiting, you know, yourself and the, you know, the potential for your life. If it's like, well, either I live in a cardboard box and I've got, you know, I eat corn dogs and I make music and that's all I care about, or I'm a total sellout and a failure and I might as well just stop. But it's taken a long time to come around to that way of thinking.
Like that, man. I like that.
Don't be the corn dog guy.
No, totally. I mean, that holds a lot of water with my life as well. You know, putting a lot of energy into this show.
I can see,
you know,
that.
and doing a day job, you know, during the day and this during the night and stuff. I mean, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Well, you just keep working and you keep making the art or the product as good as you can. And that's all you can control.
I like that. Lincoln Barr, thank you so much for coming in, man.
Thanks for having me, man. Yeah, this has been awesome.
Good. I'm glad. So, let's see. Let's plug your wares here.
Yeah.
Redjacketmind.net is where you can find out all about the band and where you guys are going to be next and everything like this.
Yeah.
This is going to be up next month. So what's happening then? You guys got some shows coming up?
Yeah, we'll be playing some shows in the spring. We're going to do a little run, go out to see our friends in Eastern Oregon and Eastern Washington in early May. And we've got a single coming out May 5th called Never Had a Bad Idea. That's the next thing out. And the Pure Delight EP came out in November. That's still our newest thing. There's a video online, you know, check it out. It's available everywhere. That's the latest and greatest.
All right, man. And follow them on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah,
and
Red Jacket
Mine
on both. Yeah,
all right,
totally.
Cool, buddy. Hey, thanks again for coming in.
Thanks
really
for having
appreciate
me.
Appreciate it. And you can find out more about us at www.air-raid.net. Click on the Archives tab and listen to all of our episodes right there for free. You can stream them there, or you can subscribe at iTunes, find us on Stitcher, and of course at CairoRadio.com. So do that. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter at Air Raid Net there. Okay, we're going to go out today with another tune from Red Jacket Mind. This one is called Engineer, and we'll be back next week with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.